Wednesday, and time for our weekly discussion of the latest news in state politics. The Dakota Political Junkies. Joining us today is Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. And Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
Roger Whittle is also scheduled to join us, but we haven't gotten a hold of him yet. So, Jonathan, you're okay to just be on your own for now, anyway?
Oh, I'm frightened now, Carl. I'm scared. No, let's do this.
All right. Well, South Dakota lawmakers wrapped up the 2015 session with veto day on Monday. Two rather obscure tax-related measures failed to receive the necessary two-thirds majority to pass, but lawmakers did override Governor Dugard's veto of a measure on how the state taxes are for electric cooperatives is determined. And the way I kind of mumbled that probably explains a little bit about how obscure some of these measures are. Were these bills, did people pay much attention to these?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think I predicted a couple weeks ago that two of the three would be vetoed, simply because, and the one in question that was overridden was one of them, but, you know, simply because the administration through the Department of Revenue had opposed those bills throughout the process. So it was kind of obvious that these potentially would be ones that the governor would take a hard look at. And, you know, and what they did is, you know, we have obviously in this state a very broad sales tax that's, been a complaint or in some circles regarded as a good thing. And I think that these bills and the governor's objections to them was that it sort of, you know, weakened or lessened how broad the sales tax are. And again, this is very limited ways, but that the governor, this governor and previous governors have been very resistant at times to carve out, I guess, exemptions for sales tax revenues.
How difficult in general is it to override a gubernatorial veto in South Dakota?
I think it's difficult across the board. I mean, you know, here you had 33% success rate, the three. There have been some times, it's difficult in the sense because I think, you know, when you have so many legislators and you need the two-thirds, it's easy to kind of splinter some of them off. You know, you have different special interests always at play. But, you know, there have been some surprising successes at times. I think of, you know, I think of 2011, the legislature stood very unified, and the governor vetoed a raise in the vehicle registration fees, and the governor had said that he was opposing any kind of tax increases, and so I was surprised that the legislature actually, on a tax increase issue, that the legislature actually overrode the governor then. But so it does happen, but typically I think the governor, you know, the executive has a lot of power in these situations.
Yeah, this legislature in South Dakota is often described as being led by the governor. Does that make a veto even more unlikely, or overriding a veto even more unlikely?
Yeah, it does. I mean, South Dakota is a state that has a very strong executive, probably one of the strongest executives, if not the strongest executive in the country. I mean, we have our legislature meets for a very short period of time, so they're not around, wielding a lot of power. In fact, you know, I think we've talked about this before. I mean, our legislature is done, and other states are just kind of starting to get going, you know. So this is definitely a strong executive, and you hear you hear lawmakers complain about that, but, you know, they've tried to implement some things in the past to try to give the legislature some more power, but I think just structurally the way it was set up by the founders in the state constitution that the executive wields a great deal of power.
Looking at veto day, was that a fairly uneventful end to the 2015 session?
Pretty uneventful. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people had hoped that, and I will talk about this, that the governor would veto a bill that lowered the minimum wage for people under 18. So I think a lot of people had hoped that the governor would veto that. That did not happen. And a couple other hot button issues. So I thought it was pretty uneventful.
Well, we can jump ahead to those issues. Voters in 2016 may have a say on that bill and another bill, opponents to the 750 youth minimum wage measure, and another bill that requires independent candidates to only receive petition signatures from other independents are now circulating referendum petitions. What are the arguments against these two measures?
Well, first off, let's stick with the youth minimum wage. I mean, First off, the voters just implemented in November a requirement that the minimum wage be $8.50 plus cost of living increases, automatic cost of living increases. And for the legislature then, I mean, the legislature legally can change these things, but for the legislature to just make a change this quickly, which lowers the minimum wage for youth, which voters just enacted, it seems to be... for some people who are really upset about this, I mean, it flies in the face of democracy. It shows to some a certain level of arrogance on the part of lawmakers, and there's that issue. I mean, there's also an issue of this sets up sort of a different class of citizens. I mean, here you have somebody maybe doing the same exact same work and can't get paid. They have a different pay level. I mean, it's interesting, and they have 90 days on both of these issues to sort of convince voters, and I think that of the two issues, this is the one that I think people will look at, and potentially I think that of the two, this has probably got the best chance of maybe making it on the ballot.
And with us on the line as well now is Roger Whittle, managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. And Roger, thanks for joining us on the Dakota Political Junkies today.
Thank you, Carl. Sorry I was late.
We're talking about the two bills that opponents want to put onto the on the ballot in 2016. We're talking about Jonathan's just talking about the 750 youth minimum wage measure, and the other one that requires independent candidates to only receive petition signatures from other independents. Roger, how easy will it be, do you think, for opponents to get the required signatures necessary to put these on the ballot?
Well, I think the youth minimum wage one, they'll have very little problem getting it on. This is, I don't know what Jonathan said, this stems from the last initiated measure we had where they got it on the ballot and the minimum wage was raised, and now the legislature has kind of flown in the face of that and started this youth minimum wage, which would be lower. So I would imagine that one would make the ballot, and I would not be surprised if it passed. The other one about... signatures for independent candidates, I'm not sure anybody is going to get real excited about that, and I wouldn't be surprised if that one never saw the light of day.
And Jonathan, what do you think about that one? Do you think that will see the light of day or not?
Well, I certainly hope it does. I think voters should weigh in on this one. It makes it more. These are the major parties here. What's happening is the major issue. And let's go back up here. What started as a way to sort of deal with some issues that came up in the last election with regard to some time frames and when to get petitions in, when there was an opportunity to challenge petitions. There was an issue that came up with independent governors, lieutenant governors. So there were some legitimate issues that came up that they were trying to deal with. And then they also work into this that, independent candidates can only get nominating petitions from independents, and that raises the bar much, much higher for independent candidates. And is that just simply a reaction to the fact that you had, independent governor's candidate, you had an independent in the Senate race with Larry Pressler? I mean, are these an effort by the major parties to sort of, block out independents? And we know from voter registrations that the number of independent voters in the state is growing, but they certainly don't have the organization that the major parties do. So I agree with Roger that I think the youth minimum wage law is something that is more clearly understood, and this other issue is more obscure. But it would be nice to see, I think, voters weigh in on both these issues.
Since the legislature wrapped up its work with veto day on Monday, two Senate Republican leaders have resigned. Majority Leader Tim Rave of Baltic is taking a job as Enterprise Vice President of Public Policy at Sanford Health, and Assistant Majority Leader Dan Lederman of Dakota Dunes is leaving the legislature to spend more time with his family. Roger, what do these two resignations mean for the Republican caucus? What do you think the impact will be?
Well, I... that's actually why I was late. I was on the phone with our Senator Reed Hoeling from Watertown, who is on the Republican leadership team, and he was saying they were on the phone with all their members very late last night, and he had some interesting insights. He said that both of them resigned effective immediately, which means they are now done. They can't even participate in electing the next leadership team. If they would have just been term limited or, you know, resigned effective at the beginning of the next session, they could have then participated. But Reed said that everything's up in the air right now. There's kind of a leadership vacuum at the top, and he doesn't expect any movement for a little while yet to choose new leaders.
Jonathan, what do you think the impact is of the resignation of these two Republican leaders?
Well, I mean, you're losing a lot of institutional knowledge there. I mean, Tim Rave especially, I mean, he was the Speaker of the House. I mean, he'd already gone through the leadership ranks in one area, in one chamber, and was headed up in the Senate. So you lose, you already have a legislature that has issues with term limits, so you do lose institutional knowledge. And so, that's an unfortunate thing, I think, when you do lose leadership like that. It's an interesting issue. There have been a number of resignations since in the last 4, 5, 6 years. I mean, there have been a lot of resignations from the legislature, and that tells you a little bit about what's going on. I mean, the legislature is not this glamorous place to be. You don't get paid a lot of money for it, and so I think at certain points of time, people have to make career decisions. And I mean, we look at Tim Ray being a majority leader, and then you look at Russ Olson, who was also a majority leader in the Senate, who also resigned because of a career decision to become a CEO of Heartland Consumer Power District. So, because the legislature is such that we talked about it before, it's sort of a weaker institution. You don't get paid a lot to be there. I think we see more resignations now when people are faced with these kinds of career decisions.
And Roger Whittle, what do you think these resignations, not only the ones we had this week, but the ones over the past few years, what do you think that they mean about the work in the legislature?
Well, I would agree with Jonathan. That I think I talked to one of our people who actually calculated how many hours they put in and how much pay they got, and it was literally cents on the dollar that you get paid for doing this. It's a lot of hard work, and it takes time away from your regular job. It's not an easy thing to do, and I'm really not surprised that this is happening. I know when I lived in North Dakota, they went to an every 2-year legislature just to combat this kind of problem of not having people able to serve.
And Roger, any speculation now regarding possible replacements in the Senate leadership?
Well, one of them suggested somebody, I think, but the governor has said that he's going to take suggestions. And he hopes to name replacements, I think he said, early in the summer. But again, I don't think you're going to see anything happen very really quick.
What about as far as replacing the majority leader and the assistant majority leader in the Senate?
That, from what Senator Hoeling said, is also probably not going to happen quick. He was talking several weeks before they everybody has to meet in peer for this to get done. So I think just the logistics of having that work out will take a while.
Jonathan, any names that come to mind that people who are already in the Senate who might be able to move into those positions?
Oh, well, I think you just look at down the line. I mean, Roger mentioned Senator Ween. I mean, that's a obvious choice. I think he's already an assistant whip. So you just look at some of the people who have already sort of been moving up the ladder. Those would be obvious choices. Yeah, but more intriguing to me is what the governor is going to do in terms of replacing the actual senators. Dan Lederman made a suggestion that Representative Jim Bolin from that district be chosen. So that was interesting that Dan Lederman made his own recommendation. That was interesting. I recall that when Stan Adelstein resigned, I mean, he made a suggestion that he hoped the governor would pick a, quote, mainstream type of Republican for replacement. So it's interesting that I think Dan Lederman went as far as he did in actually suggesting Jim Bolin.
Is that unusual for a resigning legislator to suggest a replacement?
I went back and went through some of the resignations. We talked about Russ Olson. When he resigned, I think Russ had said that, he was going to have conversations with the governor about some people who he would suggest. And then, of course, Stan, you have that just hope that a mainstream Republican. I don't recall, and I don't want to say that it's unusual, but I don't recall necessarily lawmakers actually suggesting a person by name, at least publicly. I mean, probably that gets done behind the scenes.
One law passed by lawmakers that everyone is paying attention to and is getting a lot of attention. That's the speed limit increase on the interstates going up to 80 miles per hour. That went into effect today. Roger, do you see that having much of an impact regarding traffic safety?
Well, our interstates are in pretty good shape, nice and wide, nice and flat and straight. So I don't think there's going to be much. I did read a story from the Associated Press yesterday about tires for semi-tractor trailers are only designed to go 75 miles an hour. And there was some concern that the tires on the big rigs weren't going to be able to handle the extra speed. But so far in the states that do have 80, there has been no tire failure. So I don't see it having a real huge impact on safety.
Jonathan, do you think this will have any impact on, say, the economy with tourists, perhaps getting to the Black Hills a little bit more quickly?
I don't know. I mean, you're less fuel efficient. I think I said a couple weeks ago, I think this is an effort to get more gas tax revenue because we're less fuel efficient and people have to fill up gas more often. But I don't know that what effect it's going to. I don't think it's going to have much of an effect either safety-wise or with regard to tourism. I mean, everybody already drives 90 anyway, so.
Well, President Obama is visiting Utah on Friday, which leaves South Dakota the only state he hasn't visited during his 6 years in office. Every president since Ronald Reagan has visited the state. Kennedy, Nixon, Ford also came to South Dakota while in office. Roger, do you think the president will come to South Dakota before his term is over?
Well, he has said that he wants to visit all 50 states before he's done, so I would imagine he would do that. In fact, in our editorial today in the Public Opinion, we invited the president to come to Watertown for his visit to South Dakota. Anybody can go to the Black Hills or Mount Rushmore. That's kind of cliche, and everybody goes to Sioux Falls. So we suggested he come to Watertown and see what we have to offer, and we're waiting patiently by the phone.
Do you think that an invitation to Watertown is enough, or do you think that he wants a special occasion or something?
I think a presidential visit to South Dakota is a special occasion in and of itself. I don't think he doesn't necessarily has to come for anything. I think he would get a good reception here. I know he's not the most popular president we've ever had, but I was working in Nebraska when that was the only state that Bill Clinton hadn't been to, and there was not much love for Bill Clinton in Nebraska. But when he came, I mean, everybody was respectful. He had nice crowds. Those kind of visits are usually pretty well orchestrated, so I think it would be a good thing.
And Jonathan Ellis, what do you think it would take to get President Obama here?
Well, typically you would have some kind of an event or something going on. I mean, Indian country is always a compelling issue. I mean, but the president was on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota recently, so what would it take? I don't know. Maybe the airspace expansion over at Ellsworth. But I'm trying to think of some kind of event in which a president would want to come. But certainly, if he did come, I would hope that he would get a respectful observance because he's the president.
What about the invitation to Watertown?
Well, I would drive up to Watertown to cover it.
Okay, so.
And you would have a good time.
Yeah, and I'd have a great time up in Watertown, definitely.
All right, well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies today. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
And Roger, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.